Exchanges. The Goldman Sachs podcast featuring exchanges on the forces driving the markets and the economy. Exchanges between the leading minds at Goldman Sachs. New episodes every week. Listen now.
Welcome to Tech News Briefing. It's Friday, November the 15th. I'm James Rundle for the Wall Street Journal. When lithium-ion batteries explode, they can burn hotter than a blowtorch. Clusters of batteries can present a significant safety risk, but some companies believe they have the problem cracked. And then, US officials warn that disinformation threats are more rampant and dangerous than ever before. So why is a State Department office built to combat disinformation threats from Russia and China facing closure? Our national security correspondent, Michael Gordon, joins us to discuss. But first, lithium-ion batteries are a mainstay of modern technology, powering everything from laptops to industrial machinery. But when they catch fire, it can become a huge problem, especially when dozens are placed close together. How are companies trying to prevent that from happening? By adding water. Millions of dollars have been poured into the problem, but solutions aren't as easy as it sounds. Here now to explain some of the challenges around the tech is WSJ reporter Stuart Condy. Stuart, how common is it for lithium-ion batteries to catch fire within these industrial settings, and how much of a problem can this cause?
Well, it's not common. That's the first thing to say. It is generally very safe technology, but the problem is it does happen. And when it does happen, these fires burn super hot, and you often can't put them out with water. In fact, spraying water on them can make the situation worse. Lithium will split water into oxygen and hydrogen, its component parts. And hydrogen, of course, is a highly explosive gas, and oxygen burns. So you actually end up adding fuel to the fire.
Quite literally. It burns that hot that it actually separates them into component.
Yes, that's correct. So what happens with these lithium fires is often it's about containment. Firefighters will make the surrounding area cooler. They will add water to surrounding units or surrounding infrastructure and just let the fire burn out, which is what has happened in fires in both the US and Australia.
So what are some of the solutions that people are coming up with?
Well, lithium is small and light, but it's also expensive. And as we say, it doesn't respond well to high temperatures. So if your battery doesn't need to be small or light, you can use heavier metals in your battery. And if you're using these heavier metals, this also allows you to use water, which of course is non-flammable, making batteries even less prone to fire risk.
How challenging of an engineering problem is this?
Well, it's not actually that challenging, given that this technology has been around for a long time. Car batteries have water-based electrolytes. The issue is that batteries have been focused on becoming smaller and lighter for portable use in your telephone, in your electric bike, in your scooter. But now we have the need for batteries in large-scale storage projects for solar, for wind. We can actually look at making them larger and building the capacity rather than making them portable.
Can you give us an example of a company working on this tech?
The technology is sufficiently attractive for Australia's largest power company to take an interest. Origin Energy has taken a 5% stake in Allegro Energy here and is in the process of installing one of its batteries at a coal-fired power plant that is due for closure. The idea is that they're going to test out the battery while the plant is operational, and if it is successful, then potentially roll out elsewhere.
In your story, you detail the challenges that a number of companies who have developed this tech are facing, but there is keen interest from government, from industry. So why is it a challenge for companies to get to a point where they can produce this tech in an economically sustainable way?
It boils down to the same thing as it does with a lot of technology, is that you need to prove the use case first. You need to get a project built and operational before commercializing. No one's going to plow money into a project while there are cheaper or better proved alternatives. Basically, it boils down to competition. But these companies are hoping that, such as with Allegro Energy being backed by Australia's largest power producer, that they can get these test cases out there and generate interest that way.
That was our reporter, Stuart Condy. Coming up, generative AI is supercharging propaganda efforts from Russia, China, and Iran. We'll find out why a State Department office set up to counter disinformation is facing closure. That's after the break.
Do we really need another computer? One that's faster, more powerful? Not everyone does. But to reinvent music using a neural processor, work off the grid with all-day battery, or bring your vision to life with AI-powered co-creator, then a Copilot Plus PC can make a difference. A powerful AI computer is not for everyone. But if you're trying to change the world, even if just your own, we built one for you. Microsoft Copilot Plus PCs powered by Snapdragon. The fastest, most intelligent Windows PCs ever. Battery life varies with usage and settings.
Government officials have warned that disinformation from Russia, China, and Iran is at an all-time high. The advent of generative AI has also increased the ability of foreign information operations to reach scales not seen before. Against this backdrop, the Global Engagement Center, a State Department office established to counter precisely this threat, may shut down just weeks before President-elect Donald Trump takes office. WSJ national security correspondent Michael Gordon tells us about the reasons behind its possible closure and why this is happening at a crucial time. Michael joins us now. During the election, of course, US officials warned that the public is now facing a deluge of disinformation and misinformation threats. Given that, why is the center facing potential closure now?
It's important to note that what the center does is it focuses exclusively on disinformation efforts abroad and encountering them. So what it's targeted at foreign audiences, not at American audiences. And it works hand in glove with the National Security Agency, which is one of the premier U.S. spy agencies, which gathers the information and declassifies it so the State Department office can use it. This office has a budget of about $60 million and about 130 employees. It's minuscule compared to the Goliath-like efforts that are being undertaken by China and Russia. So yes, it works with the U.S. intelligence community, which is well-funded, but this is a kind of a David and Goliath situation where the U.S. has stood up this activity and to fight a pretty focused and determined campaign on the part of information campaigns on the part of its adversaries. But the reason it's controversial is in American domestic politics, there have been debate about whether efforts to curb Russian disinformation in the United States may inadvertently trend into censorship and curb free speech. And we're identifying platforms, say on X, that are carrying Russian information, whether it's useful to shut down those particular accounts or whether shutting them down is an act of censorship. The Global Engagement Center doesn't delve into that, but because it's involved in the broader enterprise of fighting disinformation, it's been caught up in that political debate.
And it requires reauthorization, correct?
Yeah, it was authorized for 7 years. Its mandate expires on December 23rd, and unless Congress reauthorizes it, it's going to have to shut its doors there. And there's an effort afoot in the Congress to work out the compromise, but it's not clear whether one will be reached.
This is also happening a few weeks before President-elect Trump takes office. Has there been any indication from his transition team as to what they think about the center and whether they want it to be reauthorized?
No, there's been none. I reached out to them and they didn't respond. Elon Musk has been critical of the center in the past. And we reached out to X and we reached out to Musk, but he generally doesn't respond to inquiries or for comment, and he didn't in this instance. On the other hand, there is Republican support for it in the Senate because the Republicans played a role in creating the institution in the first place, first and foremost, because they see the need to counter Chinese disinformation and other foreign information warfare. The next few weeks are going to be decisive in seeing whether the mandate will be extended.
Is this coming at a dangerous time for disinformation globally with the advent of generative AI lowering the barrier for entry, allowing adversaries to increase their output and everything else?
Yeah, I mean, technologically, social media, AI has enabled Russia and China to propagate their disinformation, which really has a long history on the part of those adversaries, and to spread it very efficiently around the world. I mean, here's a recent example. There are a number of Western-funded public health projects in Africa, which are intended to prevent Africans from getting malaria and other diseases through vaccinations. Moscow, through its disinformation efforts and involving African organizations and front companies it set up, spread the disinformation that these are diabolical Pentagon biological warfare experiments and that they should be shunned. So this is an activity that not only was intended to create propaganda about the United States, but also dissuaded Africans from getting the public health care they need. And so this is the kind of threat that the U.S. is up against in Africa and in the Balkans and South America and elsewhere around the world.
Have there been any notable successes from the center in exposing this kind of information or influence operation in the past?
Exposure is sanitizing in and of itself. The way Russian disinformation works is they don't do it in their own name. They create a front organization, a publication. They find a local outlet, let's say in a Spanish-speaking country, it would be a Spanish news outlet. They propagate these assertions through them about secret biological warfare labs or whatever they're pushing. And when you expose the hidden hand behind it, that these are really not repertorial efforts by local journalists, but really directed activity from Moscow or Beijing, that obviously diminishes its effectiveness. This office, by the way, existed and did some significant work under the first Trump administration when Mike Pompeo was Secretary of State. And in fact, during that period, it did work on efforts by the Russians to suggest that the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines intended to counter COVID-19 were somehow untested and dangerous to use.
That was our national security correspondent, Michael Gordon. And that's it for Tech News Briefing. Today's show was produced by Julie Chang. I'm your host, James Rundle. Additional support this week from Cordelia James. Jessica Fenton and Michael Laval wrote our theme music. Our supervising producer is Catherine Millsop. Our development producer is Aisha Al-Muslim. Scott Soloway and Chris Sinsley are the deputy editors. And Philana Patterson is the Wall Street Journal's head of news order. We'll be back this afternoon with TMB Tech Minute. Thanks for listening.